for decades, astrophysicists have been using, a kind of fundamental measuring stick to weigh the universe.
Right.
They've used it to figure out how galaxies form, how massive stars burn their fuel, and, you know, what basic ingredients are floating around out there to actually make life.
Yeah, it's the baseline for almost everything.
Exactly. And that universal measuring stick was our own sun. The assumption was pretty simple, right? Like, the star in our own backyard is a perfectly good, reliable standard to measure the rest of the cosmos against.
Makes sense on paper.
It does. But what if the star we know best has been, well, lying to us?
Which honestly throws a massive wrench into some of the most important work happening in astronomy today.
I bet.
Yeah. I mean, when we talk about finding Earth 2.0 or trying to understand the chemical recipes required for life, all of that relies on having an accurate baseline of what we call abundances.
And abundances are just the exact chemical makeup of the universe, right? Yeah,
exactly. It's the cosmic budget. And if your baseline is wrong, you might be looking for habitable planets in completely the wrong parts of the sky. Or just, you know, totally misunderstanding the life cycle of entire galaxies.
So today we are taking you through a landmark 2012 astronomy and astrophysics paper by researchers Maria Fernanda Nieva and Norbert Prisabella.
A really incredible piece of work.
It really is. It's a deep dive into how they fundamentally recalibrated how we measure the chemical makeup of the cosmos. They essentially set out to prove that using the sun to measure the modern chemical makeup of our local galaxy is, it's basically like using a city census from 4.5 billion years ago to understand the demographics of that city today.
That's a great way to put it, because the Milky Way is this massive, incredibly active chemical engine.
Right.
Over the 4.56 billion years since our sun was born out of a collapsing cloud of gas, I mean, generations of other massive stars have lived, burned through their nuclear fuel, and died in these spectacular supernova explosions.
And every time one of those stars goes supernova, it acts like a cosmic forge, right?
Yeah.
Blasting brand new heavy elements out into space.
Exactly. They are constantly enriching the interstellar medium. That's the sprawling, swirling clouds of gas and dust between the stars. They pump it full of heavy metals like iron, carbon, and oxygen.
So the universe is getting richer in metals over time.
Yes. And because of that continuous enrichment, the chemical makeup of our sun only represents a frozen snapshot of the galaxy's past.
A fossil.
Right. It's a fossil record of what the interstellar medium looked like 4.5 billion years ago. So if you want to understand the structure of young stars forming today, anchoring your mathematical models to a 4.5 billion year old fossil is inherently going to introduce massive errors.
Because the present day universe has had billions of years of extra metal injected into it since the sun was born.
Exactly.
Okay, so if the sun is too old and outdated to be our measuring stick, that leaves us looking for a modern alternative.
You need something fresh.
Right. So why not just point our telescopes at the coal gas clouds in the interstellar medium right now? Or, you know, look at a nebula where stars are actively forming and just measure what's there today.
Well, astronomers have certainly tried that approach. Specifically, they've looked a lot at HII regions.
And HII just refers to ionized atomic hydrogen, right?
Yeah. It just means areas where the radiation from young stars is so intense, it literally strips the electrons right off the hydrogen atoms.
Like the Orion Nebula.
Perfect example. Places like Orion are glowing brilliantly, and they seem like the perfect obvious sites to measure current chemical abundances. But we run into a massive physical roadblock.
Oh.
It comes down to a phenomenon called depletion onto dust grains.
Depletion onto dust grains, meaning the elements are physically present in the cloud, but our instruments are, what, completely blind to them?
Basically, yes. To understand why, we have to look at how we measure these things in the first place. We rely on spectroscopy.
Right, where you take the light from a distant object and split it through a prism into, like, a rainbow barcode.
Exactly. A rainbow barcode. And every chemical element absorbs light at very specific wavelengths, which leaves these dark lines on that barcode.
So you can just read the lines and know what's there?
Normally, yes. But that only works for elements floating as free gas atoms. In the cold interstellar medium, and even in warm nebulas, a huge portion of heavy elements like carbon, magnesium, silicon, and iron, they cool down and condense.
Oh, they stick together.
Right. They clump up and form solid dust particles.
So they get locked away into literal cosmic soot.
Cosmic soot, exactly. And those solid dust grains, they do not emit or absorb light in the same neat, readable spectral lines that free-floating gas atoms do.
Wow. So they just vanish from the barcode.
They completely vanish from certain types of spectroscopic observation. So to know the true total chemical abundance of that region, you would have to know exactly how much of each element is hiding inside those solid grains of dust.
Which is a total catch-22. We can't know what's in the dust unless we measure it, but we can't measure it because it's locked in the dust.
Right, it's incredibly frustrating.
Okay, so if the sun is an outdated fossil and the gas clouds are actively hiding their metals from our telescopes, we obviously need a third option.
We need an object that captures the present-day chemical reality without hiding anything.
And this is where the paper comes in. Nieva and Preisbiller realized that the heroes of this story had to be unevolved, early B-type stars.
Yeah, B-type stars are magnificent objects. They operate as the perfect cosmic laboratories to solve this exact observational crisis.
The paper lays out exactly why they are the ultimate candidates, and honestly, their physical stats are wild.
They really are.
First, they are massive, right? Usually between 8 to 18 times the mass of our sun.
Huge.
Second, because they are so massive, their gravity crushes their cores intensely, making them burn through their nuclear fuel at an incredibly accelerated rate. So they only live for about 10 million years.
Which is nothing compared to our sun's 10 billion year lifespan.
Exactly, a blink of an eye. And third, their atmospheres are just searingly hot.
And that extreme heat is what solves our first major problem, the dust.
Oh.
Well, because B-type stars are burning at such intense temperatures, dust simply cannot physically exist in or near their
Oh,
atmospheres.
it just burns up.
It vaporizes. Any solid grain of carbon or iron is instantly vaporized back into a gaseous state. That means every single atom is liberated.
So it all shows up on the barcode.
Exactly. It all shows up clearly on the spectroscopic barcode. Nothing is hidden from our instruments.
Okay, so the heat vaporizes the blind spot. That's brilliant. But how does their short 10 million year lifespan solve the age problem we had with the sun?
Well, in galactic terms, 10 million years isn't even a rounding error. It's incredibly brief.
Right.
Because they live such fiercely short lives, they simply do not have the time to physically travel very far from the exact gas clouds where they were born.
Oh, I see. They stay close to home.
Yeah, they serve as these pristine, completely untainted time capsules of the local present-day interstellar medium. Whatever chemical mix was floating in the gas cloud yesterday, basically, is locked inside the star today.
But wait, don't stars churn up their own insides? Like, I know our sun has these massive convection zones where material from deep inside boils up to the surface.
Yeah, convection.
Right, so if a B-type star is fusing elements in its core, wouldn't that core material boil up and contaminate the surface readings? Like, mix with that pristine time capsule.
That is a crucial distinction, actually. Because massive B-type stars are so incredibly hot, their internal physical structure is completely different from our sun.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The intense heat transfers outward purely through radiation rather than boiling and churning like a pot of water on a stove.
Okay.
So the surface layers don't mix with the nuclear forge down in the core. The surface remains a completely pristine, undisturbed sample of that original gas cloud.
Okay, I have to push back here though.
Go for it.
If early B-type stars are the flawless, mathematically perfect measuring stick, why didn't we figure this out 30 years ago?
Yeah.
I mean, the paper itself points out that past historical studies using B-type stars were a complete mess.
They really were.
Yeah, their recorded chemical abundances were wildly all over the place. Some looked poor in metals, some looked completely overloaded with them.
Right. Well, the stars themselves were indeed perfect, but our tools and our models for analyzing their light were, frankly, fundamentally inadequate.
Also,
Analyzing the light from massive stars is incredibly difficult because the physics of their atmospheres is highly complex. They're often spinning very fast.
I read an analogy for this. Trying to read the spectral lines of a rapidly spinning star is essentially like trying to read the license plate of a car doing donuts in a parking lot.
Yes, that's exactly it.
The letters just smear entirely across your vision.
Right, and past studies had massive margins of error because those spectral lines were blurred. The paper notes uncertainties of 40 to 60% just in calculating a star's surface gravity,
Wow.
and a staggering factor of 3 to 5 in determining their elemental abundances.
A factor of 5. That's huge.
It's massive. When your error bars are that astronomically large, a highly uniform group of stars is inevitably going to look like a chaotic, wildly diverse population.
Just a total mess.
Yeah. So Nieva and Preisbiller recognized that to fix the standard, they essentially had to, well, pull the car over to read the plate clearly.
Right.
They selected a highly curated sample of just 29 stars in our solar neighborhood.
Why just 29?
They had to be perfect candidates. They had to be single stars, not part of a binary system, because overlapping light would confuse the readings.
Makes sense.
And crucially, they had to be what we call sharp-lined, meaning they were rotating extremely slowly.
Ah, so by picking slowly rotating stars, the researchers stopped the smearing effect.
Exactly. They got incredibly crisp, sharp spectral lines.
And then they pointed some of the highest resolution spectrographs on the planet at them, right?
Right.
Instruments like FOCES, FAROS, and ELOTI.
Yes, to get extremely high signal-to-noise ratios. But having a clear picture was really only half the battle. They also had to change the underlying math of how we model a star's atmosphere.
Moving from LTE to non-LTE.
Right.
Let's unpack that a bit. LTE stands for local thermodynamic equilibrium, right?
Correct. In older, simpler models, astronomers assumed that the star's atmosphere was in a perfect state of equilibrium, that the temperature and pressure in any small local area were perfectly balanced.
Which I'm guessing makes the math much easier to compute.
So much easier.
Mm.
But in a massive, searingly hot B-type star, reality is far more chaotic than that. Photons of light are constantly escaping, energy is transferring violently, and matter is interacting with radiation in highly complex ways.
It's not balanced at all.
Not even close. So non-LTE drops those simplifying assumptions. It actually models the chaotic, atom-by-atom physical reality of the star's atmosphere.
And they didn't just run this complex model for one parameter.
Yeah.
They created this brilliant methodological trap, I guess you could call it,
yeah,
by evaluating multiple independent indicators simultaneously.
Yes. They use something called ionization equilibria.
Work me through that.
Okay, to visualize this, imagine you are looking at the element silicon in the star's atmosphere. Because the star is so incredibly hot, silicon atoms are constantly being battered by radiation and stripped of their electrons.
So they become ionized.
Exactly. Some silicon atoms lose one electron, some lose two, some lose three. The researchers measured the spectral lines for silicon the second, silicon the third, and silicon the fourth, all at the exact same time.
Okay, I see where this is going.
Right. So the mathematical model had to produce a surface temperature and a surface gravity that made the total abundance of silicon match perfectly across all three of those different ionization stages.
Oh, wow. It's like solving a cosmic Sudoku puzzle.
Exactly like that.
You can't just artificially tweak a number to make the silicon the second line fit your theory, because that would immediately break the math for silicon the third and four.
Right. Every row, column, and grid of the physics has to align perfectly.
And the reason surface gravity and temperature are so vital to get right is because they constantly fight each other.
Yeah. Yes. Gravity is pulling the star's gas inward, making it dense, while the intense heat is pushing the gas outward.
And that exact balance dictates how thick or thin the spectral lines appear to our telescopes.
You nailed it. And the precision they achieved by forcing all these parameters to agree was just staggering. They nailed down the effective surface temperatures of these stars to a 1 to 2% uncertainty.
That is incredible.
And surface gravities were determined to less than 15%.
Which completely shattered those old sloppy margins of error.
Completely.
And when the math finally snapped into focus, that wild, chaotic spread of different chemical abundances from the old studies, it completely vanished.
It vanished. The new, highly precise data proved that the young stellar component of our solar neighborhood is not a chaotic mess. It is highly chemically homogeneous.
Meaning they're all made of pretty much the exact same stuff.
Exactly. The fluctuations in the abundance of heavy metals from one star to the next were less than 10%. And those results perfectly matched the gas phase measurements of the local interstellar medium. It turned out the universe wasn't disorganized. We just had bad math and loose modeling.
So by fixing it, they established the true cosmic abundance standard.
Yes. We finally have a reliable present-day measuring stick. The data proves that the local universe is thoroughly and efficiently mixed. The turbulence and the shock waves in the interstellar medium distribute these newly forged heavy metals incredibly evenly across vast distances.
Okay, but wait. If we're using stars that are so hot they completely vaporize dust, how does this new measuring stick help us figure out what's hiding in the cold, dusty gas clouds we talked about earlier?
Ah, right.
Because we still can't see the dust directly with our spectrographs, right?
Right, we can't. But we use the genius of subtraction.
Subtraction.
Yeah. Hmm. The B-type stars give us the total pristine chemical budget of the gas cloud they form from, with absolutely nothing hidden. We now know the exact total baseline of the universe.
Oh, I see. Okay, so we take the new total budget from the cosmic abundance standard, and we subtract whatever elements we can clearly see floating as free gas in the cold interstellar medium,
Exactly.
and whatever numbers are missing from the ledger. That has to be the exact chemical makeup of the invisible dust.
You got it. The math simply reveals what the telescopes cannot see. And because the precision of this new standard was so tight, they could make definitive statements about dust composition that were previously completely impossible.
That is so clever. And the paper notes that when they applied this subtraction method to the Orion HR region, the data imply that carbonaceous dust, so dust grains made entirely of carbon, is largely destroyed by the intense radiation of the forming stars.
Right. But silicate-based dust, which is essentially cosmic sand and rock, actually survives the radiation.
They also discovered that graphite is only a tiny minority species in interstellar dust, which was surprising.
Very surprising. And this has massive implications beyond just our neighborhood. Astrophysicists spend enormous amounts of time trying to model how the light from distant ancient galaxies is absorbed and scattered by dust as it travels across the universe to our telescopes.
Right, because if you don't know exactly what that intervening dust is made of, you can't properly correct for how it distorts the light of the entire cosmos.
Exactly. So this standard is foundational.
Okay, so the Cosmic Abundance Standard solved the invisible dust problem, but it also resolved a major debate about how massive stars actually fuse their fuel, right? The paper dives into the CNO cycle.
Yes. Massive stars don't just smash hydrogen atoms together directly like our sun does. They generate energy through the CNO cycle, where carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen act as chemical catalysts to facilitate the fusion of hydrogen into helium.
And the paper notes that out of their pristine sample of 29 stars, a few of them were slightly older and actually did show signs of internal mixing, where that processed nuclear material had dredged up to the surface.
They did. But instead of throwing off the data, it perfectly validated our theories.
How so?
Well, the theoretical physics of the CNO cycle dictates a very specific chemical balance. As the cycle runs, it consumes carbon and produces nitrogen. The researchers mapped the changing ratios of these elements in those slightly mixed stars.
And the data track flawlessly along the theoretical nuclear path with a slope of 4.6.
Exactly.
Meaning, for every bit of carbon that was consumed in the core, the exact corresponding amount of nitrogen appeared on the surface, matching that mathematical slope of 4.6 predicted by stellar evolution models.
Which means our theories of how massive stars burn their fuel were entirely correct all along.
That must have been a relief.
A huge relief. They just looked wrong in past decades because we were starting with an inaccurate baseline. Once the cosmic abundance standard was applied, the theoretical models and the observational data locked together with incredible precision.
Which brings us to the plot twist of the entire paper.
Oh, yes, the big one.
We spent this whole time establishing that the galaxy constantly enriches itself with heavy metals over time. Therefore, the young 10-million-year-old B-type stars in our present-day neighborhood should naturally have significantly more heavy metals than our 4.5 billion year old sun.
That is the logical assumption, yes.
The universe today is simply more metallic than it was back then.
The logic holds perfectly based on the laws of galactic chemical evolution. But when the researchers finally compared the new, highly precise cosmic abundance standard of our modern neighborhood to our ancient sun, the numbers were entirely backwards.
The sun has too much metal.
Way too much.
It's not just a slight deviation either. The specific recipe of the elements is fundamentally different. The researchers found that the ratio of carbon to oxygen, the CO ratio, between the sun and our current local neighborhood differs by almost 50%.
And a discrepancy of that magnitude simply cannot be explained away by time or slow chemical evolution. You cannot evolve the chemical makeup of our current local neighborhood backwards by 4.5 billion years and somehow arrive at the sun's specific highly metallic chemical signature.
It just doesn't work.
It doesn't. The math leads to one unavoidable physical conclusion. The sun was not born in this part of the galaxy.
It is a cosmic immigrant.
It is. To really conceptualize this, you have to look at the massive structural gradients of the Milky Way.
Okay, picture the galaxy.
Right. The inner galaxy, closer to the supermassive black hole at the core, is incredibly dense.
Mm.
The cycles of star formation and supernova explosions happen at a much faster, more violent rate there.
Right.
Because of that, the inner galaxy has always been significantly richer in heavy metals than the outer, quieter suburbs where the Earth is currently located.
So the inner city is heavily industrialized, constantly pumping out more heavy metals, while the galactic suburbs are much more sparse and pristine.
Exactly. And the exceptionally high metallicity of our sun, combined with that specific carbon-to-oxygen ratio, is an exact match for the chemical signature of the inner galaxy as it existed 4.5 billion years ago.
Which means, over its 4.5 billion-year lifetime, our sun has been physically migrating outward from the intergalactic disk.
Yes.
And the scale of that journey is just difficult to comprehend. By reverse engineering the chemical fingerprint, the researchers determined that the sun originated from a birthplace about 5 to 6 kiloparsecs away from the galactic center.
Right.
And we are currently sitting about 8 kiloparsecs from the center. Just for scale, 1 kiloparsec is over 3,200 light years.
That means a migration of nearly 3 kiloparsecs implies the sun has drifted across 10,000 light years of actual space.
Navigating through dense spiral arms, dodging gravitational hazards, and crossing immense cosmic voids over billions of years, just to eventually settle in the quiet galactic suburbs where we find ourselves today.
It's wild. It entirely rewrites our understanding of our own history.
It really does. I mean, we started this journey looking for a simple measuring stick to weigh the universe. We realized our old standard, the sun, was a flawed relic. So we found a new standard in the short-lived, fiercely hot B-type stars.
And by completely dropping the flawed LTE assumptions and applying rigorous atom-by-atom physics, Nieva and Percivala cleared up decades of blurry data.
They gave us the cosmic abundance standard. And with that single tool, we deduced the makeup of invisible cosmic dust, we proved our theories of stellar fusion, and we accidentally discovered that our own solar system is a wanderer that fled the busy, metal-rich inner galaxy for the quiet suburbs.
It's an incredible chain of discoveries.
And this isn't just a story about abstract math or distant gas clouds for you listening. This is the origin story of the exact atoms that make up your physical body.
Exactly.
The oxygen you are breathing right now, the carbon constructing your DNA, the silicon and iron forming the earth beneath your feet. They were forged in a completely different, vastly more violent neighborhood of the Milky Way.
Just think about the staggering chain of events that implies. The sun is born in the chaotic, metal-rich inner city of the galaxy, which is exactly where it needs to be to gather the dense, heavy elements required to build a rocky planet like Earth.
Right.
But that inner city is also highly irradiated and dangerous, plagued by frequent sterilizing supernovas. Yet the sun manages to drift outward for billions of years, parking itself perfectly in what we call the galactic co-rotation radius.
A safe zone where the gravitational forces and the spiral arms are relatively quiet.
A quiet, safe suburb where life actually has the time and the peace to evolve without being wiped out by cosmic radiation.
Wow.
If our sun had to pull off that incredibly specific 10,000 light year migration just for us to exist, how many other wandering stars out there might be carrying that exact rare recipe for life, silently drifting into the safe zones of the galaxy?
Are we the only immigrant star that hit the jackpot? It really makes you look at the night sky completely differently. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. Keep looking up, keep questioning the universe around you, and we'll catch you on the next one.